Hello?
Hi, Cheryl's on.
Hi, John.
Hey, John, how are you doing?
Okay.
Anybody else on yet?
Yes, Stephanie's on.
Hey.
Hey, this is Leanne.
Hey, Leanne. Sorry we're late. I was having, twice I dialed in and dialed in with the moderator code and it said you'll be placed on hold till the moderator joins. Cheryl tried and it liked her. Whatever, she dialed in better than I did, although we thought it was the same thing.
So I hear John, Stephanie, Leanne, Stag, Cheryl. Who else?
Cindy.
Hey, Cindy, welcome. Sorry we'll miss you at Biltmore, but welcome on the call.
Thanks.
And
I think Ann should be on, but she hopefully hasn't been called away to an emergency.
Yeah. Tom Gower's not on. I'm not expecting Anna because she's in Europe, and Allison said that it's her birthday, so she can't come. They kidnapped her for a birthday party. Geez, I wonder why. She'd think that's more important. But anyhow, Kathleen Tucker? Well, let's at least a little bit launched here.
Mike's
nope.
In Iraq.
Hmm? Yeah. And Beverly Brock may or may not be on. I don't know if she's quite tumbled to.
No, Beverly said she couldn't join tonight.
Oh, she? Okay.
Yeah. So we've got a quorum.
And so my call for questions didn't get many flushed out, but at the same time, since I had some of my own, and I think there are probably some other people on the call who also have questions.
And Cindy had hers about negative splits.
Cindy had hers about negative splits. I'd like to, actually, why don't we invert things a little bit, because there's a part of me that and start with Cindy's, which basically is on the negative split. And since John and Stag are both on, let's throw it to them and open a discussion, and maybe we can all pitch in.
Okay. Cindy, do you
yep.
I think the question was fairly general, but do you want to be more specific or just have us?
Well, why don't you start with general and see where the questions go then? Would that be okay?
Okay, yeah. Of course, the concept is to set a pace for the ride in which you pick up the pace each leg of the ride, assuming the horse is indicating that he's got plenty of reserve in the tank. And there was a couple articles in, I think two articles, at least one in Endurance News that should be on the ARC website. I must admit I haven't checked for them since they were published by Kim Fuse that talks about the concept. I think the, I don't necessarily ride negative splits myself. Or rather, I try to ride an evenly paced ride. It also depends on the horse and the status, you know, where I am in the horse's development program. But what I do is a couple, I think, of very important things related to the concept of negative splits. I think one should do the first leg well within the horse and probably slower than the average pace for the ride. So that's consistent with the concept of negative splits. The horse in the first, depending on the horse, it may be anywhere from not at all to an hour or more, is going to be running with an excess of what I'll call the flight reflex hormones, basically adrenaline, et cetera. So the horse is going to want to go fast, and unfortunately, one of the things that happens when the horse is in the flight mode is the electrolytes and other usage are actually more concentrated, and therefore they're losing critical electrolytes and other things faster than once they're no longer in the flight mode and once they're fully warmed up. All of which says you need to be particularly careful in the first loop of a ride to keep plenty of reserve in the tank. So I will very consciously go out in the first loop of the ride at a slower pace than what I think the horse can do for the entire ride. John, you want to chime in on, as I said, I will then try to ride a fairly equal strategy for the rest of the ride, but I evaluate that in each loop and then decide whether to speed up or slow down. Somebody else just joined.
Yeah, I think
that
a true negative split, you know, strategy really only has a lot of accurate meaning on the really simplest, least technical courses. And
okay.
most of our American courses have so much variation in legs of the course that you would probably only make mistakes if you tried to stay too close to a true negative split policy. Because some legs might be a bit more strenuous than others. So that's the first thing you have to recognize. You know, unless you're racing in Dubai where it's all just flat, you know, and the same thing, leg after leg, you're never really going to achieve an exact negative split condition, even if that would theoretically be correct. So it's harder to really follow that exactly on most of our American courses. The other thing is Stag's right. The first leg, if there's anyone to be a little bit more conservative, it's that first leg, particularly, you know, on a 100-mile course in particular, because that is when your horse's efficiency is less, and so his metabolic exertion tends to cost him a little bit more in that first leg before they relax and become very efficient. So it's easy to overexert at even a more conservative pace in the first leg. And so that's something to always watch for, and particularly for a younger horse or for a horse that's been out of training for some time and is just coming back into the fold. I'll make sure that the first leg and probably most of the second leg is done particularly conservatively, if there's going to be any careful legs at all. You want to always make sure that you finish bright. That's the bottom line. So for me, it's not so much a matter of looking for negative splits, but just looking for negative exertion levels.
Okay.
Which is a little harder thing to peg yourself to. But you might call it a negative split in exertion. You know, you want the horse to be doing his greatest work later.
Okay. And then this is Ann. I chimed in again. Also related to that somehow, and we don't know how, is that the myositis horses that we see early in the ride are a lot sicker and more intense than the horses we see later in the ride. And I think it's correlated somehow. Nobody's really studied all that, but it's very much related to what John's saying.
When horses, I think one of the problems with some of those myelitis, you know, conditions that happen early, one of the problems that your horse can have is, like I said, he's not only is he in the first legs is a horse possibly in that flight or fight mode as Stag was describing, or just basically it's really adrenaline up very high. Nothing about his body is working at its best efficiency. And one of the things you achieve by a seasoned athlete is the fact that they get through that phase quicker, if it bothers them at all. And nothing about his body is working at very high efficiency, including the way his muscles release and relax between each between each cycle, between each stride. And I think that the efficiency of the of your horse, particularly a young horse, you know, or any excitable horse, and particularly a young one in their first legs, is just way down, and you have to recognize that. It's important to notice that and pace for an even exertion rate or a slightly increasing exertion rate through the ride. And that probably, for many horses, particularly young ones, is to be extra conservative through the first leg and a half.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think it's useful for people to know examples. And again, it's also very important to know your horse. Every horse is different. Druban that I campaigned for so many years, it was pretty predictable. Somewhere between 30 and 45 minutes, I would typically see a pulse drop of about 10 to 15 beats from the, say, low 130s into the high teens or something. At that point, he'd gotten rid of his flight reflex hormones and chemicals, and he was also, his body temperature was fully warmed up. And then he was working very efficiently. And at that point, I'd go ahead and let him use his bigger gaits, his bigger flowing trot or an easy hand gallop, but never until I saw that change. The most dramatic example Cheryl and I had was the 1992 National Championship ride. We started in 19 degrees. I mean, it was cold. And we never saw that pulse drop for the first 25 miles, you know, over 2 hours into the ride, because it was so cold, the horses weren't working efficiently. And so we just kept our horses in these sort of comfortable working trots. And we came in to the checkpoint, like, I don't know, 17th and 18th. And, I mean, Druban had come into that ride already having won 600s that year. So, you know, it was everybody sort of saying, what's going on? About a mile or two out of the first checkpoint, so we're now 26 miles into this race, all of a sudden we saw that pulse drop, which meant the horses finally had warmed up, and then we started letting them pick up the pace, and we ended up crossing the finish line second and third, and then the leader got pulled, and we ended up first and second in the ride. But that's sort of a dramatic example of, you know, keeping the horse under wraps until they're really warmed up and working efficiently. Another ride, which was one of a ride where I did not ride well, was, and Ann was the chef to keep at this ride, and I think John was, you were a farrier, I think, right? I don't think you were riding, was the 2003 Pan American Championships, where Super, who's a very wound horse, you know, got really excited early in the ride, but we could never get alone. You know, if I slowed the pace down, the next group would catch up. If I speed it up, I caught up with the next group. And he stayed hyper for the first 40 miles and then came into the 40-mile check and started shivering because all of a sudden he cooled off and it was low humidity and all that, and we clipped. And in that ride, I'd moved up into second place at the 70-some mile checkpoint, or 67, whatever it was. But then he started running out of get up and go because he had stayed too high too long from excitement, even though I wasn't really letting him run fast. And there's a long hill coming into the last checkpoint in the finish line that we'd practiced galloping up, and I got to do those on foot off the horse. We finished fourth, but it was really one of the worst rides I've ever done. You know, we lost ground on the front runners late in the ride, and his recoveries weren't, you know, just a lot of things weren't right, and that was because I couldn't get him calm in that working mode. You know, in retrospect, what I should have done was pulled off the trail for 3 or 4 minutes early in the ride. You know, let bunches of horses go past me. Could have easily made up that time late in the ride, but because he stayed in this hyperdrive mode, you know, it really, you know, cost me. Against very horse dependent, I'll give one other example and then shut up, and that is we took Cheryl's new horse, Orion, who's one of these horses that's just a totally laid back Arab in its first endurance ride. And we waited 5 or 10 minutes for all the other horses to leave camp and then started out in a very controlled working trot. And sure enough, for the first 30 minutes, we saw this pulse rate about 15 beats over what a good working training pulse rate was. And then the pulse rate returned to the normal, in this case, 110 levels, and the horse was working efficiently. Not Charles' horse, Orion. He worked efficiently the whole time. It was damn super, you know, who at this point was a 15-year-old horse. But, you know, it was just, he still knew it was a competition. So, Cindy, I think I've gone, haven't exactly addressed negative splits, other than I think John and I both emphasized how important it is to wait till the horse works efficiently. And then, you know, then you can let the horse pick up the pace, always keeping reserve in the tank until late in the ride, and then you know, then if you've got lots of horse left, you can run one of these really fast last legs if you need to. Although, John, you should comment on your typical strategy, say in the Old Dominion late, and how you ride the last part of the ride.
I don't know, but the truth is, I mean, the last part of the ride is, for me, I ride to race or against competition that much. I'm just kind of out there sort of trying to estimate what is my horse's optimum exertion rate. Beyond being a little careful that first leg, I'm trying to estimate what that is and dialing to it by the middle of the second leg. You know, that sort of exertion rate, not necessarily pace, because pace has to change with the terrain. But what I feel is the exertion rate that he's up to for the day. Until this thing, you know, and to some extent, I'm looking to dial to that, you know, pretty soon. And I'm not really ever thinking that much about, I mean, I'm noticing what other riders are doing, but I won't really change what I'm doing. Based on competition, until perhaps the very last leg, I'll look around, and very often that means you can back off and coast in if you're in the position you think you're going to hold for that ride. Which, you know, if you're in the front or if you're in some position where you realize it's half hour to the next guy anyway, somewhere in the course, you know, wherever you're ranked, then you coast in with that. With the exception of probably the younger horses, I almost always, on my horse's first 100 in particular, make sure that I kind of underpace a little bit right on through until the last leg, because I really want to have that horse finish feeling bright and be able to, just for his own, for the development of a good attitude in the horse, the horse remembers, I think, finishing a ride feeling bright. So I'm likely to kind of deliberately underpace myself on the young horses, not just because I'm not as sure what they can do, but because I want to make particularly certain that the young guys get to finish their first few races feeling like they're somebody. And I think that's something I'd like to instill in them.
The other point I would add is to what John said. A large part of it is knowing how your horse feels at comfortable paces, at pressing the pace, and then also I probably override to my heart monitor. You have to ride the horse, not the heart monitor, but keeping the horse in the right heart range, which is something you should learn from your training rides, because it is varies by horse. But it, you know, if I know a course really well, I will actually set sort of times to ride each leg, or if you can get those times from the records. But very few courses provide the detailed, you know, by leg records. Obviously, you know, if you've got a huge mountain in the middle, you're going to have to slow down. I lapped at Tevis last year. You know, I did pull at 60 miles because I felt the horse wasn't right, but some people, they had posted my time wrong on the website, and there was this thread about had I overpressed my horse in the middle of the ride because all of a sudden I'd done a, I don't know, it was like a five-mile leg in 20 minutes. That five-mile leg had a 2,000-foot canyon in it, and the only way I could have done that in 20 minutes was to have leapt the canyon. And it was actually an hour and 20 minutes. I'd been slowing the pace down. But that's sort of the extreme case of, you know, how terrain affects what will be what you frequently can't predict unless you know a course very well is even if you don't have big climbs, I find single track versus, say, logging trail can make a minute, a mile difference in comfortable pace easily. Sand will slow you down, again, a half minute to a minute, a mile.
Side hill.
Yeah, riding on the side of a hill. So, unfortunately, we're not giving you formulas, but it's all about, you know, watching how the horse feels and then, you know, using your pulse monitor as an aid.
Do you want to move on at this stage?
Well, let's see if anybody on the call has more specific questions.
Yeah, exactly. And
Cindy, have we helped at what you were asking about?
Yes, most certainly. I was having a hard time trying to figure out how you could apply, you know, the pure concept of negative splits to various terrain. I mean,
I think about the only place I know where you might be able to do it is something like the Fitz Ride in Florida.
Okay.
Okay. But even Biltmore, you know, I could probably write out the pace at Biltmore, but it wouldn't literally be a negative pace because some of those loops are just much slower than others.
Okay.
And that's because I know Biltmore, you know, extremely well. But it's much more about keeping your – I like to think of it this way. Keeping your horse under wraps, I mean really within itself, till it's really warmed up, and that may well be an hour, hopefully less, sometimes more. Then riding at a comfortable pace, particularly if it's 100, I like to think the first 50 miles is a training ride, and then at each hold reassessing, and then at the end, you know, when you're getting into the last 20, 25 miles, you know, if your horse is coming in and recovering immediately, you see the other horses are tiring, because your crew's monitoring how long it takes them to recover, you know, then you say, okay, I'm going to go after and pick up the pace. Or the other extreme, and John is the absolute master at this that I've learned from, is, geez, I've got a 30-minute lead on the next horse that might catch me. I'll give away 20 minutes of that, you know, because I'm now saving my horse for the next competition.
NBC.
NBC, yeah. It's a strategy of BC. Okay.
So kind of a summary of what you guys are saying is that if you think in terms of not a time split or a speed split, it's more of a physiologic split, negative split.
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's a good way to put it.
Well said.
It's the best estimate of what a physiological negative split would be.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. I would like, since Anna's joined us, to hit up on a piece of information for the full members, and that's the Yahoo site that you've established for group. Yeah, you want
right? Well, I think I started the Yahoo group, and I sent out invitations to the other board members that hadn't signed up. I think John, I sent you one, and Dinah. I don't know if Dinah's on, but And then what you do, I think, is you write me back, and then I accept you. So what you guys have to do is if you send me an email, then I go into the Yahoo group and invite you in, and then I guess you reply to that email through the Yahoo group, and then I say, yes, this person's okay.
Now, has that been sent out to the other full members yet, Anna?
I only sent it out to the board members to start with.
Okay.
And only some of us actually did it. And I don't know if I had addresses wrong, but I'm perfectly willing to keep trying. But I did. I know this morning I sent out to John again and Dinah.
So I think we'll...
So if you guys want to write my email address down, or if, I don't even know if it's on our website or whatever, but and send me an email, then I'll start the process through the Yahoo group to get you in there, which involves pushing two or three buttons. It's no big deal.
Yeah, and that would be for all the full members. And it's a Yahoo-type discussion group, so...
Yeah, and it's members only, so that's why I have to accept you and approve you. So do you guys want to write down my email address?
Sure.
Or it's just my name, Ann Stewart, A-N-N-S-T-U-A-R-T, at T as in Tom, D as in dog, S as in Sam, .net, TDS.net. And you might just put in the subject something like Yahoo group so I don't delete you. And then, you know, we could even, you know, bounce around ideas for the next conference call on that group. And, you know, it's just like any other group, you know, like Ride Camp or whatever people are on, where you can just knock around ideas. We can also post JPEG images on there. Swellings on legs, x-rays. I had to put images on there to open folders, but one is, I think, called x-rays or radiographs or something like that, and then another one is confirmation. And I just made two folders and stuck a picture in each one. So if we wanted to start compiling information in those folders, and then, you know, we can certainly do other folders with text in them, and have those to refer to. I can say, hey, look at this imbalanced foot before and after pictures and put them on there. You guys can put pictures from home, from your farrier, or, you know, whatever you want to put on there. And then put in a post, email, that says, hey, Ann, or hey, farriers, look at the hoof picture I just posted, or whatever. And we can look at those and put our brains together on them.
We could put Jake's Sequestrum on there.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, one of our horses just had a little Sequestrum, had a Sequestrum, which meant he had to have a bone chip removed from his leg, so we can put the x-rays on there in case anybody wants to see those.
Just as something you don't necessarily see every day, but it's a pretty classic thing in its way. So I think that's got a lot of potential, and we probably ought to try to exploit it among us-ins. And a number of you probably are already members of various and sundry web groups, so this will be no particular difference than what you've already experienced. But I think it's pretty cool. Then the other things that I wanted to sort of explore. Well, let me, before I go on to other things I wanted to explore, any questions about the Yahoo group?
Well, just from a full member, boy, would that be helpful, because then you can post, like you said, hoof pictures and say, hey, what do you think? You know, where should I be heading with these feet? That sort of thing. That would be absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, and if you've got, you know, copies of blood work, you can post those, you know, whatever.
Right.
And then we can also just knock around, hey, I rode last Saturday and this happened, and what do you think? And then we can all put our two cents in.
At your leisure type thing, instead of everybody coming together at 8 o'clock one night a week and trying to cram everything in.
Yeah, and then we can
that
we
would be
perhaps for these conference calls and maybe make them even more academic.
Right.
Like I said last night on our board call, I'd be happy to, you know, spend a little time, put my nose in the internet or in a book, and get some more academic information to talk about on these calls.
Well, right. A lot
I can
of
talk faster than I can type, but
Well, my vet always has questions when I'm saying, you know, I want to give 40 milligrams of selenium for the next month to boost these levels up to 2 to 250, and she wants to have a heart attack and die right there.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it would be nice to say, you know, hey, I can post it and see what you get back.
Right. to send the emails, and I'll accept you.
That sounds great.
Okay. I'm just going to do a quick admin type thing. I've heard occasional beeps, and people may be dropping and rejoining. But
Troy, I just joined.
Hey, Troy.
Hi.
And this is Tom Gower. I joined about 15 minutes ago. I was a little late.
Okay, great.
Any snow up there, Tom?
It snowed today.
No.
Oh,
wow.
I'm so sorry.
We're expecting snow tonight.
Thanks, Day.
Oh, Lord.
Rub it in. It didn't stick, but yes, we had flurries on and off all day today.
You are on your way down to Biltmore shortly, right?
I'm, pulling out tomorrow sometime.
Yay. Okay, well, weather's beautiful down here.
Yeah, I actually don't feel too sorry for me because I've got probably 3 inches of nice grass pasture, but it was a little bit of a rude delay to have that snow today.
Yeah. Oh, my.
Okay.
Ah, your winter this winter has been just, in some senses, it would have been great posts on the Yahoo group just because it's like nobody has winters like this, but Tom had that winter.
Yeah, when you have to start plowing your horse paddocks to keep them in, that's when you know it's way too much winter.
Yeah.
I have a question for Ann, if she'll field another question.
Yeah.
I was wondering what your thoughts are on hydration or hydrating a horse prior to a 100-mile race. Would you do it? What would somebody expect to pay to do that?
Like IV fluids, you mean, or nasogastric tube?
No, IV fluids, I guess.
Well, I'll just tell you what I charge is $10 a liter and $30 to put an IV catheter in.
How many liters would be normal, do you think, for hydration?
Well, maintenance for a horse is about 25 liters, just standing around maintenance, 25 liters in a 24-hour period. That's just standing around breathing. So, you know, I probably wouldn't give more than 10, 15, maybe 20 liters for prehydration. Part of the problem you get into there is you turn off their physiologic stimulus for thirst much more than you do anyway. So, you know, I don't think it would hurt anything to run 10 liters. I think if you start running 20 liters, you might start affecting physiology more than I would feel comfortable with. 10 liters is perfectly reasonable.
What's the advantage of that?
I noticed that in Abu Dhabi, all the Europeans seem to be, and I think the Arabs as well, seem to hydrate their horses on a Friday before a Saturday race. Well, I guess for super hydration is, I mean, right? I mean,
yeah, so you start out a little bit ahead.
And I guess they're getting some electrolytes in that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's balanced electrolyte, just like their serum, plasma.
And then would there be a way, I guess, during a ride to, you know, to evaluate, I guess, through a lab, how they're utilizing, how their hydration is working?
Yeah, in that one entity, that one physiologic entity of your horse. And then the question is, what does it mean? Because you don't have anything to compare it to.
Yeah.
But, you know, you might later. It would be information.
That's kind of what I'm wondering. I wonder if you don't start to accumulate some baseline data on your horse.
Yeah. I mean, it would be a handful of numbers to start with. And then, you know, what does it mean? Well, we don't know until you compare it to other things. And then realize when you start comparing to other things, other rides, so many other variables. But the more numbers you get, the more the variables level out.
Mm-hmm. And if you were to look at labs during the course, say you look, when would you draw labs during a ride if you wanted to have something that might be valuable to look at and learn from later? When would that?
I do it every loop.
Every loop. Yeah. Okay.
Now, John.
Yeah.
I haven't exactly followed where the board and the new vet rules came out on this. So for ARC rides, but could you sort of remind all of us, or Anne, one of you, just what the current state of those rules is?
I believe the state of the rules is you can draw blood if you'd like. I think you're supposed to, you should notify whoever. I'm not 100% certain, but I believe the state of the rules is you can draw the blood, you're not allowed to see the results.
Right. I remember something like that. I'm wondering if you saw the results afterwards and you had something to then work from for the next ride or future rides, you might have more information about how your horse is.
I would love to, you know, if I had more access to getting blood work done, I would love to have a pattern of drawing blood before each race, mm-hmm. at least at the first vet check and after the race.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could do it every vet check, that'd be great. But those would be the ones that I would suspect would give you the most insight.
And how do you feel about hydration after being around the world? I mean, what do you think?
I think that I don't believe that there's probably that much benefit, you know, if things went well in getting to the race,
mm-hmm.
and giving your horse, hydrating him before.
Mm-hmm.
It only sort of helps make sure that he isn't starting from a deficit for some strange reason.
Right.
And so that means maybe 97% of the time it's meaningless, but maybe 3% of the time it's a good advantage.
Hey, it's Anna. Just beat back in.
Yeah.
I don't know at what point I disappeared.
Anne, one of the questions that I would have, because I certainly have never, you know, hydrated my horse by IV fluids before a race. I generally, you know, basically, I guess a fairly recent practice or practice at the highest FEI level, is the, I know of a horse, you know, that competed on only one, with only one jugular because the other jugular had collapsed because the horse had had to have a lot of IV fluids due to some medical condition. The horse was actually owned by a veterinarian who competed quite successfully on the horse. But what are the risks of either repeated IV fluids or, you know, things like that?
Well, a horse is in thrombosis waiting to happen. So a healthy horse, it's a lot lower risk, but a horse that has a non-sterile catheter placement, and although brief, we place usually a long catheter sterilely, to administer any more than, you know, a few cc's of any kind of medication. So longer catheter, sterilely placed, not a huge catheter. I usually use 14 gauge in a horse unless they're really sick, and then I go to a lot bigger gauge. But, it's not without risk. Anytime you start sticking needles in anybody, there's risk. But horses really do like to make blood clots. And they're potentially not just that you lose a jugular vein because you've got another one on the other side, but potentially fatal from emboli, just like in people.
That's what thrombosis means.
The thrombosis is a clot that looks like, when you pull them out at necropsy, this is totally disgusting, but I'll tell you, it looks like a black snake. It's this big, long clot that you can pull out of their whole jugular vein.
And I guess horses are more prone than people just because they clot faster. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, you know, everybody's physiology is different, but horses are very, very, very prone to clotting. I guess it's because they like to run through fences and stuff and bleed a lot, so.
Yeah.
It's probably some evolutionary adaptation to clot well. But, I don't think it's a big deal to run 10 or 15 liters of fluids to a horse. I do it a lot and don't get thrombosis, but there is risk.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting because I know a lot of the Europeans, when they arrived from flying their horses overseas, they gave them fluids.
Now, that's kind of different, is the transportation, the hydration during transport. And some people will do oral fluids and IV fluids all the way through the transportation.
Really?
Yeah.
And but then,
and that's a whole different ball game then.
Back out hydrating them the day before the race.
That's different.
And I guess that's just, you know, I would assume that's just to make sure they're not 5 or 10% behind on their hydration even.
Yeah, and you can tell very quickly if they're 5 or 10% dehydrated. I mean, by the time they're 10% dehydrated, you can see it in the physical exam, and those are all the things on your vet card, the first few things on your vet card. But you can also see it if you do a packed cell volume, hematocrit, or in a total protein. So it's easy to tell if they're dehydrated. Now, the question is, is their plan to overhydrate a bit to get ahead of the game? And then if you stand back and look at the big picture, are they really getting ahead of the game if they have altered their thirst response?
I'm not sure that you really can overhydrate for more than an hour.
Uh-huh.
You know, it doesn't take the horse that long to start pissing it away.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, it seems to me one of the disadvantages, if you're putting, let's see, 10 liters is 2.5 gallons. I guess that's an extra 20 pounds. So you are putting extra weight in the horse, unless they piss it out, in which case you've negated the effect anyway.
Right.
I just don't. I haven't ever done it, and I guess if I thought it made a huge difference, I would have been doing it.
For me, I think that it's you know, the experience, particularly all the long shipping I did this year. You know, I would love to have blood tests done after shipping, particularly if I wasn't able to measure every gallon the horse drank. And I would love to start seeing my horses get a little better monitoring how much they drank in shipping, and I wouldn't hesitate to give them some fluids after long ships anymore, particularly if I had any indication that they either drank less than they should have, or their you know, their blood test showed that they had. As far as doing it just before the ride, I'm a little bit skeptical of really doing anything is advantageous there, because it really doesn't take the horse that long to correct whatever you thought you were doing with overhydrating, and he'll just urinate more and fix that in a few hours, and you can't be giving your horse an IV that close to the race start.
And then the other negative might be that they forget to drink for another
right.
8 or 10 miles.
Right.
Whereas if you hadn't given them that extra fluid, their hypothalamus would have clicked and said, I'm drinking this mud puddle, which they might not have thought of if they had been a little overhydrated pre-race.
Yeah.
So is there like a urine dipstick you can use on a horse that will test for specific gravity and those kind of things that you can
use? Yeah, it gives you a range on a dipstick, but good luck catching the urine. My God, you know, you stand there for hours.
I know, but I wonder if that would be an easy. I mean, you know, if you're messing around with them anyway, if you had one of those, some of those dipsticks in your pocket, if you could do that, if that wouldn't be an easy way to tell if they actually are dehydrated or not.
The best thing is to feel their gums and see if they're sticky.
Really?
And yeah, that's your most sensitive, quick clinical parameter is if their mucous membranes are tacky.
Uh-huh.
That's the first thing you'll see before you'll see it on a skin pinch or anything else.
But are they getting 10% behind on their hydration when they get sticky gums?
Yeah, they're probably 5 to 8 by the time you see that.
Yeah. Okay. I'm just curious if that's even that.
Yeah.
That might be the difference between some of these horses that, you know, finish really well and others that don't.
Let me suggest the following, because I know there's some other questions that Carol has and all, is maybe for the 2 months from now or so, we actually have a call focused on the whole strategy around keeping your horse hydrated, you know,
mm-hmm.
from, you know, trailing to the ride, at the ride, during the ride, and after the ride. I have more questions than answers, particularly after, you know, Todd Holbrook's talk down at the clinic in Georgia this winter and other things I've been learning, and we could use the Yahoo web group to pose all the questions, and then Anne will give us all the ultimate answers or something. But
if I could only find them, if I find them, I'll give them to you.
But I think this would be a great example of what Anne was saying is have a discussion ahead of time, and then we can do some research and bring collective thoughts to a call maybe a couple months out. Because it is a great topic and probably one that we just don't know a lot.
Transportation stress is another whole topic, and that's what we were talking about with John and shipping all over the place. And those horses, I would be shocked if they're not dehydrated.
If
I could add, this is Cindy. I did try the horse quencher for the last two rides I did, trailering, and it is true. You add a cup of that to a gallon of water, and all three of mine just drink it right up in the trailer.
Wow.
It's great.
Cool. I didn't believe it till I actually saw it. But
had you tried it at home, or you tried it on?
Oh, I tried it en route.
En route, okay.
Yep.
Well, that sounds...
It's worth the $25 to try to get a a container of it and try it. I would at least they're getting something in.
Yeah, that's something I definitely then need to try, because I think the reason Super had problems at Biltmore last year is he didn't drink well. It wasn't the long trailer ride. We lived 3/4 an hour from the ride site, but once he got there, he didn't drink the day before the ride for God knows what reason.
Mm.
And we pulled at 60 miles. I wasn't riding him. I was helping Gerald, on the ride. But the rider who was riding him pulled at 60 miles, and he was dehydrated.
That's an interesting note on the horse quencher, because I've looked at their ads, and their ads look too good to be true. But
they did. They did look. The first time I gave it to them, it was a cold day. And I gave it to them at home in some warm water, and you think I had just offered them hot soup, And they just, all three of them just, were pushing to get at the bucket. And I then did a five-hour drive, and they drank, halfway. They each drank a half a bucket. And this last weekend we came home. We went to Maryland and back for the Foxcatcher, and we'd stop every couple hours, and they would still continue to drink a half bucket of the stuff. I don't know why, but they like it.
Right.
Yeah. That's pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. It is.
I know we gave a bunch of packets away at Biltmore last year, and I'm pretty sure we have one or two in our trailer, and we just never use them. Just goes to show you how much... Yeah. Anyhow.
Well, I will add to that I tried to get them to drink it at the hold during the ride, and they wouldn't touch it during the ride. but in the trailer, it was pretty good stuff. But, when they had plain water and they were thirsty, they preferred to drink a bucket of water to the bucket of thirst quencher.
And that may be because you were electrolyting them with a concentrate.
Could very well be,
and they're trying to dilute it back out.
Well, that would make a lot of sense. Smarter than I think.
Yeah. They got us all fooled.
Yeah. That's true, I think.
You know what they say about Gatorade and your own response. If you truly need a little bit of electrolyte, particularly a light amount in the water, your body's perception of it, the reason, will change when you're slightly low on electrolytes. But if your electrolyte program on the ride was keeping up well, the perception of what salt tastes like, or what that little bit of electrolyte in the water tastes like, won't change. When you need electrolyte, salt begins to taste more like sugar. If you drink Gatorade and your perception that day is it tastes like you were drinking somebody's urine or sweat, then you probably didn't need salt.
Don't try it.
If you drink it and it tastes like some kind of nectar, then you probably did need the salt.
Huh.
Don't do a comparison study. Don't do it.
I didn't know that.
Anyhow, as I think Stag has proposed, we ought to do hydration strategies probably for our next call and just kind of really focus on that and build a whole unit on it. And maybe we can table it for the time being. Just want to spend a bit of time on the question about Plan B. It's sort of like, when do you go to a Plan B? Clearly, in some senses, and some of this has come up, this is Cheryl as ride manager. I'm getting a lot of pulls because one way or another, people don't think their horses are right. And Cindy, you pulled because you didn't think your horse was going to be good enough to come down to Biltmore and do well. So, and Stephanie, you pulled because Jake has a gash on his...
Bubble boy. I need bubble wrap for that horse.
Oh, no.
He's the kid that gets on the playground and has a black eye and a bruise every time he comes home.
is he getting over that? Or?
Yeah, it's just a gash, and I keep treating it. If he stands too long, it swells. He's not lame. He's never been lame on it, but it's gashed open, so I think it would give him problems if I pushed him too far. But he's not lame. He trotted out fine. It just looks real ugly, and I'm afraid to get it infected until it closes up.
Yeah.
And Cindy, how's your horse coming along?
He's doing very well. He did well at the Foxcatcher. I mean, we were middle of the pack, but he finished very strongly and was as high as a kite yesterday. Well, actually, yeah, yesterday, yeah, Sunday. He felt really good, so I was very pleased with that. I felt good. He felt good. It was a positive experience.
Great.
And Biltmore would have been too much, so now we're looking at the Pine Tree 100.
Yeah, and it's sort of like...
Well, there's another 100 before that you should be looking at, right, John?
There are at least 200s before.
There's two. The Top of the Rock, where the national championship's going to run, is doing 100 on June 1st.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
Uh-huh.
Where's that?
Indiana, Henryville. It's 20 miles north of Louisville, Kentucky, right across the Indiana border.
And from this part of the world, it's a 6.5-hour trailer ride, Troy.
Mm-hmm. Is that the same trail that y'all went up this past weekend or a couple of weeks ago?
It's almost identical. They ride a little bit different for Top of the Rock.
It's a little different. They don't go across the highway and into that nasty part where the loops were out. That was just a horrid trail. But they don't go across there. They stay on the same side of the mountain, basically, and all the loops are in camp. All the vet checks are in camp.
Sufficiently different, and at the same time, it's a nice rolling course. And I would hope by the Top of the Rock they will have had a bit less mud. And then there's also the Michaux 100 in Pennsylvania, and what Stag was going for was OD, of course.
Well, how hard is it? How I was thinking I might do the, this is Cindy, I was thinking that I might do the 50 or the 55 at Michaux and then decide if I wanted to try or just go do the OD 50. Oh, I don't know. I'm on plan K. I had to laugh when you said plan B because I've gone through so many plans now that...
And frankly, the plan B was your email to me when you pulled from Biltmore is what somewhat inspired this. Plus, I got kicked in the mouth a week or so ago up at the Henryville ride, Chicken Chase. And my horse is on rehab. And it's like, okay, I'm on a plan B, but it's a serious plan B. And
she didn't really get kicked in the mouth. Her horse popped a curb.
I wasn't sure.
All her teeth are still in her mouth.
I blew it is what it amounts to. But in any event...
Why do you think that you blew it? I mean...
Because I think he was telling me fairly early in the ride that there was something screwed up, or at least the vets told me that he was telling me this. And anyhow, independent of all that, it's like, it's when is it that, okay, you go to a plan B? Is it when it's something subtle with your horse is not quite right? Or, you know, like, hey, look, I got presented with a fact. I'm going to go to a plan B. I don't care what it is that I wanted to do. I'm going to a plan B.
I think it's both. It's a question of if you can recognize the subtleties and then interpret how important they are.
Yeah. And some of this is...
John, you talk about this sort of
yeah.
psychic read of your horse's physiology coming over the crest of a hill thing. And, you know, that is very subtle. But that's a level of intuition and knowing the horse as an individual, you know, versus a glaring orthopedic injury, a gash on the leg. I mean, those are the extremes.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, a lot depends on whether, I mean, where you feel like you're getting this, whatever this is that you think is your reason for doubting your plan. First you have to define, is this something that is what kind of risk is it? Is it really a risk of damage or just a risk of less performance than you might want to have? In other words, if you think your horse may have gotten a contusion or injured something that could be threatened, you know, that could threaten his soundness later, then I take that a lot more seriously than just going there and maybe not getting quite the performance I think I should be and just pull out of the ride early. So I think the biggest part is if, you know, defining whether or not I think this is a soundness or a recoverable threat or not.
Stephanie's gash is going to be a different situation than Orion's curb.
Right. My gash just took me out of training for a couple weeks, and it would be my horse's first 100 and my first 100, and I just didn't think with that time off and just that nagging thought in the back of my head that I was going to be ready to take him through 100 successfully.
Right.
So it's easier for me to wait 1 month and know that he's going to be okay, and I'll feel more comfortable taking him to the top of the rock doing the 100 and knowing that, you know, I'm going with a sound horse as opposed to one that is pretty stoic when it comes to any type of hurt, you know, muscle or anything. He's stoic and will push through it.
And that's a different amount of downtime than, say, a big fat core lesion in a suspensory branch or
a high
leg, you know, take a year off, cross your fingers sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be easier for you to bounce back than a suspensory horse would that had a certain type of lesion in its suspensory. Or, fracture is the extreme. I mean, if you think in terms of tissue types, mm-hmm. and generally the softer the tissue, the faster it heals. The harder the tissue, the slower. So a cut or a pulled muscle is going to heal a heck of a lot faster. And pulled muscle, there's a lot of different kinds of pulled muscle, but say middle of a hamstring, little tear, as opposed to an origin or an insertion tendon, they're going to heal a lot faster than a fracture is the other extreme, or a bowed tendon.
And the completeness of the heal is a lot of the healing ability is a lot more. You know, if you feel like
and some tissues don't heal completely ever.
Right. If you have a dent, if your concern is that maybe in some way his dense tissue is somewhere stressed out, that's something to back away from, really, because if you overdo that, you never get all of it back.
You can look,
and just, will I get my horse tired? Will I make him muscle sore? You know, that sort of thing. But that I can take a chance on if I really thought I just needed to get around the mileage, you know. But I don't take any chances when my suspicion is a feeling that has related to dense tissues.
Is that making sense to you guys?
Yeah.
It's actually quite helpful, I think.
So, and then there's judgments. I'll just, you know, this is maybe not a very glorious story, but I'll tell you that at the Vermont Pan Ams, we had a horse with a big muscle cramp in the middle of a big muscle. It wasn't an origin. It wasn't an insertion. It wasn't anywhere near a tendon. It was a big cramp, maybe a bit of tear, but we didn't know at the time.
that on the team vet side of things chose to nurse that through because we were in medal contention and we got the horse through and got a medal and it was fine. Now, if that had been a suspensory that was swelling, no way, Jose, would we have let that horse out of the vet check. Mm-hmm. And that's a judgment call, just knowing the different tissue physiology. Mm-hmm. So that comes from a lot of experience and training and years of school. And then what you guys, as riders, you have your experience that you learn from. And then you call us veterinarians once in a while if you need some more information. All that stuff we learned. But, you know, you just have to go with what you know on a certain level and then call for reinforcements if you need help. So the subtleties that John sees, and he knows a lot about lameness, you know, he can interpret a lot of that stuff for himself. Cheryl, maybe you should have gone with your first answer and maybe you thought too much and talked yourself in or out of something. And then you call me, and then I come out there and tell you what I know from my experience in education.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you have to tie it all together.
Yeah. Thank you.
In that case, we, in Cheryl's case, I think we all thought we were dealing with just some muscle tightness and we retrotted and the horse was getting better and all that, and then the horse came across the finish line and actually I trotted behind the horse because the vet check was like a quarter mile away and the horse looked fine, and within 10 minutes the horse had tightened up, but we all missed
grade four.
Yeah, he went from, you know, looking fine to really obviously off in the rear, but we still all missed the diagnosis till Ann got out there 3 days later and found that we weren't dealing with a muscle. We thought it was the gracilis, I guess. Is that the right muscle, Ann?
Yeah.
But the one deep inside the leg.
Yeah, and it turned out it wasn't that. It was
like the groin muscle.
Yeah.
It was the curb lower down. But Ann, maybe, and John both, as you're bringing horses back, I mean, we've got Cindy's horse, which is doing nicely. She felt wasn't ready for Biltmore, but now is feeling better, you know, ready to go. We've got Stephanie coming back from a fairly minor cut, and then we've got Ryan, you know, who'd been doing beautifully, who's now coming back from a, you know, well, first of all, he has to get through the 4 weeks stall rest. Every time we see him, we tell him to take that, you know, hold that against Ann, not against us.
Yeah, and Ann may come out in 4 weeks and say, you know what, we need more time in the stall. And,
okay.
You know,
it's actually looking quite good today, fortunately.
It's good.
We were out there. But anyway, some general guidelines on how you assess, you know, bringing horses back from this and you know, how they're ready.
Well, to me, it all depends on what the original lesion was, if we can even define it as a lesion. And, you know, that's where I sort of have an easy job because I can point at things and palpate them and put the ultrasound probe on them or radiograph them or whatever, and I can point at a lesion, hopefully, if I can find it. It's kind of better if I don't find one. But if I find it, then we can define it and talk about parameters around that specific problem. So you look at a ligament, and you're looking at initial healing of weeks to months, and then physical therapy phase is probably a couple of months after that. This is a case scenario, depending on the extent of the injury, that sort of thing. And there again, you talk about a suspensory core lesion, you're talking about 8 months to a year. You know, your plantar ligament injury, you're talking about a few months, probably. And then you just have to start back slowly and see how things go.
I think part of my mental chew is, okay, now he's fine. I ought to be able to start back hard, not slowly. Bad.
No.
Bad.
Bad. And when the Newmans say they're going to go for a little trail ride, they like go zooming up the mountain like a 30-mile loop or something, which makes their vet tear hair out. But you have to, I mean, you think in terms of you hurt your knee skiing, and then you've got to go to physical therapy after that, is what I try to remind people of of how a ligamentous injury can be as devastating as a fracture as far as the rehab time. So you're just lower on that, on the scale, because of what ligament it is. But you're not going to be able to, after, if say, worst case scenario, 6 weeks in the stall, jump on them and take up the mountain.
Gee.
You know, you probably have to look at, you know, first ride being, you know, training ride, and then first competition being slow to, and watch and walk.
Well, wasn't to increase your herd.
Well, the herd right now is at its semi-optimum level, it's, other than two of them aren't here. Anyhow.
It's the weakest link concept.
Yep.
You know, his cardiovascular physiology is going to snap back, and things are going to be looking good, and he's going to be feeling good. His muscles will be feeling good, and that's all those things will go out and re-injure a plantar ligament in about 10 strides, if they're really exertive strides.
Mm-hmm. Well,
it's another part of that would be, was this? I guess another part of coming back from any injury is if you can try to assess what caused it, and then avoid those conditions until the horse is, you know, totally recovered. So in this case, you had a horse injury that was probably caused by the horse, you know, stepping in some really deep mud and, you know, it grabbing him and pulling, because that's the nature of that ride. It was some really deep mud. So that means the horse needs to avoid that type of terrain. Miss Stephanie's horse, till it's well healed, she doesn't want to go doing a ride in sand. But am I
and every structure is different, and so you have to take them each individually. But with a plantar ligament, which is it's right down the back of the hock. If you guys don't know what we're talking about, it's a curb in horsey language. But it's the long plantar ligament, and it's like what comes off your heel into your plantar fascia in your foot. And if you've ever had plantar fasciitis, you know it's chronic many times. So what happens in these horses is, like if you have a sickle-hocked horse that's got a conformational predisposition, those guys are prone to curb injury. The other thing is a sudden, violent pull on the ligament. And then, so probably what happened is he took a bad step, and then he probably took a few hundred or thousand bad steps after that, and it probably just got worse and worse and worse. But to start that process, this isn't the kind of injury that's overuse, or it would probably be both legs, you know, through the mud. I think he took a bad step and slipped, and it's usually that they slip with their foot up under them. Mm-hmm. Think of stressing the back of that hock. It would be a sliding stop in a reining horse, or a slip in the mud in an endurance horse, or a slip on a rock. And so then, if you think in terms of how he's going to rehab, he doesn't need to do a lot of sitting down transitions. You know, really, you need to be cautious engaging his hind end and collecting him and going downhill. And any time when he would sit down to ski down a hill on his back legs, you know, that's going to be, you know, a long time down the road before you should feel safe doing that on him.
So there would not be a plan. How would you do that, though? Shouldn't you have a plan to strengthen that particular ligament and leg?
Well, you can't really condition and strengthen a ligament that much. I mean, you can over a long, long, long period of time. But what you need to do is baby that thing while it rearranges its fibers and heals, because that healing process is going to take more months than we're going to have him in the stall and hand walking.
Mm-hmm.
So then, you know, you go to physical therapy, and what you do in physical therapy is you just barely push that limit over and over and over again, and you push it farther and farther and farther over time. So he's going to be flat, you know, relatively hard ground to start with for rehab, and going walking down hills, being really cautious on these gravel, things that might slip that foot up under his belly, which is probably how he injured it in the first place.
So that's talking about a plantar ligament. And then if you're talking about a flexor tendon or, you know, a collateral ligament or, you know, any other specific injury that might happen, you have to take those on an individual basis and baby them in their own way. And all of your other physiology is waiting for that to get better to a large extent. You can get some conditioning in, but you got to be careful because they don't think, and you can't really tell them a whole lot. You have to be the brains behind the operation.
What
if you guys
various
remember
types of injuries, Anne, you know, from, I would say, cuts to, you know, bones to ligaments and tendons, muscle strains, what are the medical diagnostic tools now that, you know, one should think about using?
Other than physical exam, some people swear by thermography. I think it's a pretty superficial read, but it's another tool. And then radiology, ultrasound, MRI is a new thing that's expensive and available in certain places, but might as well get insurance on your horse before you have that conversation. But there's pretty much anything available in horses now that you can get at your human doctor.
Okay. Like for muscle strains, though, do ultrasounds help there or that?
Yeah, you can see if there's fiber separation and hematomas in there.
Okay.
And what parts of the anatomy can you realistically do ultrasound on equines?
It depends on your probe, but you can only get a few centimeters below the surface. So that's where you get into a problem with the horse's giant muscles. But you can do any, you know, you can do joints, you can do cartilage in the stifles, you can do all the tendons and ligaments in the distal limb, which is where most of the lamenesses happen.
And this, when you do that, can you explain to me, I mean, are you breaking down cells and then just rebuilding stronger?
When you're healing or when you're doing, are you talking about therapeutic ultrasound?
Therapeutic ultrasound.
Okay, because we were talking about diagnostic, but I can talk about therapeutic for a minute.
Yeah, well, I didn't mean to switch gears, but...
No, that's fine. And that's something that...
Curious.
Yeah, I think it's underutilized in veterinary medicine, honestly.
So you don't
but,
think it's snake oil, then, I gather?
Oh, no. I love... I go get ultrasounded at PT, and I get fixed pretty quick. And so you're increasing the temperature... Physiologically, you know, it heats up the tissue, and you got to be careful and keep the probe moving because it'll burn the tissue.
Uh-huh.
It increases collagen fiber production, and it increases the alignment. It's more regular alignment of the collagen fibers as they're formed.
Hmm. Okay.
I mean, it's just all proven by biopsy, and you know, it's pretty hard science.
When would that be indicated?
What was that?
When would that be indicated?
Well, like I said, it's underused. I think for soft tissue repair, not early, but in the later phases of healing,
mm-hmm.
I think it's probably important. I mean, I know personally I'll limp around on something for 4 to 6 months, and I go get ultrasounded a few times, and I'm fixed. And I don't know if you just get hung up in a certain phase of healing, but I don't own a therapeutic ultrasound machine. I've got a client that bought one off of eBay, and sometimes we'll borrow it in ultrasound horses.
And is it as effective on old injuries as new injuries? I mean, old as in...
They're really, really old, and they're all scarred down, and they're quiet, and there's not much
yeah.
happening physiologically in there. You're probably not going to get a whole heck of a lot out of it.
Okay. All right.
But I will say, on one infamous ride, the stag loved to tell people about that I did not complete. It turns out that my horse had a walloping huge hematoma inside, I would call it his groin area, the muscles up through there, and I mean, he had a melon size, grapefruit size, not melon, but grapefruit size hematoma up there. And we did use the therapeutic ultrasound on that over a period of weeks, and it really did heal very beautifully.
If you think in terms of an acute injury, you don't want to heat up something that's already hot and inflamed, okay? So you want it to be quiet, and you want it to be going into the situation where it's making new collagen fibers and trying to line them up correctly, and then you help it along at that point.
Uh-huh.
So like for Stag and Cheryl's horse, it would be, you know, we're talking about if we were to have that discussion, it would be in another few weeks. Because the last thing you want to do, like I said, is go in there and heat something up that's already too hot.
Right.
But an old gnarly scar, you know, or an old thick injury from a couple of years ago, I'm probably not going to get anything out of it.
Okay, all right. That's exactly what I was wanting to hear or wanting to know.
Okay, anything else at this stage?
I've got one more little thing I can add there to, for the other listeners is that, you know, we talk of, for all those times when you've been a good trainer and you've noticed something might be not quite right, maybe your horse is a little off, you're not quite sure. If you're, you know, hopefully you've been able to stop these things before they're actually conclusively diagnosable, and you've just put him out for some rest. And maybe by the time you try to get him over to your vet, but in the next day or so, it's already receded to the point where they can't make an exact diagnosis anymore. And the rule of thumb that I use in that condition is that I sort of, from the time I put a horse into rest, I kind of count the number of days that it's taking him to get to where I think there is nothing, absolutely nothing wrong again. In other words, if there was a bruise in the foot, I can't find it anymore. If there was something that just had me a little concerned about palpating a leg, the time that it takes me to not find it anymore, or just something about the way his movement comes back to normal. So I notice how much good rest it takes him to get from where I was somewhat uneasy with something about him to where I'm completely comfortable again. And he stays in rest for about 150% more of that time again.
Uh-huh.
That's my rule of thumb when I've been able to stop it before it's really a diagnosable breakdown.
And that was 150%, you said?
Yeah, I use 100, you know, that's kind of my rule of thumb. If I know my horse took 10 days before, you know, after something I noticed wasn't right, and it took him 10 days before he got straight again, he's probably going to rest another 15.
And I think
that's... And that's for subtle things, and that's a great, you know, way to look at it. It gives people some sort of a cookbook to follow, because, you know, you're standing there scratching your head. I would much rather that whatever it is go away and never be able to put your finger on it, because if you can put your finger on it, it's pretty big, whatever it is.
Right.
If I can find it with my fingers, or I can find it with my ultrasound, or find it with the radiology, gosh, you know, from a veterinarian's perspective, it's like, hey, there it is, bingo. But, you know, it's not necessarily a good thing to find.
Right. Good trainers don't make it so easy on their vets.
Yeah. It's fine with me. I love to go, you know, and the lameness is gone, or I can't quite put my finger on it. I'd rather see that for the horse and the rider than say, gosh, here's a thing we have to deal with.
The interesting about Orion is the obvious lameness was that we'd seen was gone when Ann came out, but Sheldon still knew he wasn't quite right. And we think that the obvious lameness was actually the secondary lameness, where he was compensating for the primary, and then by the time Ann got out, the primary cause, which was a more subtle lameness, but it was there, was the curb. Let me just leave with one, almost a thought and a question that John or Ann or others may want to comment on. And it goes back to actually Troy's original question about, you know, putting fluids in horses. I think for... my hypothesis, and I don't know that we have enough data, is there's a large difference between these flat, fast races, particularly in fairly warm weather, where horses are going well under 8 hours and hundreds, the lead horses, and much more the classic hundreds, which may be one in, you know, 13, 14, 16 hours, something like that, where you're asking a horse to go over difficult terrain, you know, for many, many hours. And those, you're keeping a horse in an aerobic working state most of the time, although clearly some of it could be very anaerobic when you're doing some of the steep climbs. But the horse has to have enough reserves, if you like, to, you know, handle that type of long duration challenge. Whereas these horses that are galloping these flat, fast races are really working much more up in the anaerobic range. And I know that there's some work. Jim Baldwin, unfortunately, could not share everything he learned, but even some of the acidosis, alkalosis balance and all in these horses, in these type of rides, is very different from what we see in the classic, you know, Old Dominion and Tevis and even Biltmore type rides. So I guess one is that true? And two, does that mean that we have to be very careful that we don't start using principles that are suited for a very different type of event than what many of our ERC events are?
That is a big, complicated question, Jack.
Yeah, it is. I realized as I said that it was complicated.
Austin, I love it here.
I can tell you that, you know, acid-base balance is a whole another lecture, but, you know, back in the old days when I first was learning this exercise physiology stuff and about endurance horses, everybody said, oh, they're all alkalotic. They're all alkalotic. You got to use saline when you treat them IV. You can't use lactated ringers because then, anyway. Bottom line is most of these horses that are sick or having a problem are actually acidotic. So I think even the horses at Tevis and Old Dominion that get sick or get imbalanced and maybe don't tell us about it are acidotic. So that blows the old theory of the alkalosis versus acidosis. So does anybody even understand what the heck I'm talking about?
Yes, it sounds good.
Sure.
You know,
throw your old books out the window is what I'm telling you. Throw those old books out the window. That's what you need to know. That's just a huge physiology whole can of worms, Stag.
Okay.
Having to do with aerobic and anaerobic metabolism and waste products and all that. Most of them are acid-type waste products, though. There's just less of them if you're staying in the aerobic zone than if you're anaerobic.
Okay, so discussion best held for another time, I guess.
Yeah, maybe an acid-based lecture or something, you know, and we can.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a.
Well, it is. I mean, we've talked about it at clinics. There very likely are different types of horses that are suited for different types of terrain. They're best suited for different types of terrains.
Yeah, and remember Dinah's picture with the different colored muscle fibers, the type 1 and type 2, and then the different subtypes?
Mm-hmm.
It all goes into, you know, genetics even.
Right.
So.
And just how that horse moves. I mean, some of them just move so much more efficiently at a canter than a trot. And there's so many variables that come into play.
Right. And how hydrated they are and what their electrolyte balance is and how excited they are. Everything we've talked about tonight all factors into it. So we have to table that one for another day.
Okay. It's a fascinating thing about the sport. The more we learn, the more questions, the longer the list of questions gets.
I know it.
Okay. I think we're at a good spot to wrap. Is there another? I thought there was something else that we were going to talk about, but I don't remember what it was.
Well,
guys, send me emails, and we'll talk about it on the Yahoo group, and then maybe we can start one file of conference call topics or future lecture topics, and we can start hacking away at our file.
Okay, and I will try to – I took some notes tonight, and had a request from a couple people, so I'll try to put out some fairly short notes on the call tonight, but you know, and people are welcome on the Yahoo list to correct, edit, et cetera. Probably won't get those out for a couple days. I've got a couple of work things that are going to demand my time in the next 48 hours. Possible may not even get it out to Biltmore, because then I got a ride manager who's going to demand a lot of my time.
Ah, blow off.
Right. And we'll look forward to seeing some of you at Biltmore.
Well, I'll have Wisconsin beer and brats, and I think I picked up three types of cheese today.
Oh,
everybody's welcome.
You said the right word, Tom. I
sure.
Love that cheese.
Come find me.
I think we got to make sure the ride manager keeps a place for Tom next to
him. Excellent.
Tom, I'll be looking for you.
Okay. You know where I am, and I've got lots of goodies.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks, Paul.
Please be safe, okay, on your trip.
Right, everybody.
Safe travels,
yep.
Everybody, in all your different directions.
All right.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.